Thank you, Mr. Shoemaker. So we live in interesting times, and we've been talking about some of the things in the church that we have to deal with, and some things out of the church we have to deal with, and we're going to continue that theme and look at something else that I think is important for all of us to consider, and it relates to a verse in the book of Proverbs, and that's found in Proverbs chapter 22, verse 3. Proverbs chapter 22, verse 3. And what's laid out in Proverbs chapter 22 is a principle that we can all follow. It's a principle that applies to various things. For instance, this is a verse that supports the idea of insurance, and it supports other things as well, as we'll see. Some people say you don't need insurance. This verse tells you probably it would be prudent to have insurance. It says in verse 19, it says, so that, Proverbs 22, verse 3, it says, a prudent man foresees evil. A prudent man foresees evil, and what does he do? He hides himself. He seeks to protect himself from the evil that is coming. And so it supports the idea of having insurance because, you know, we look out and we see, you know what, I could have a car accident, I could have a serious health problem, I could have a health accident, injure myself in some way. There are various things to happen, so I know that that may happen, and I don't want to pay the money for the insurance, but once the disaster hits, then you know what, you're thinking, I'm glad I had that insurance. I know that the time that having something like this that is a kind of a protection really struck home with me was when we'd let the AAA card expire. And I was out in the wilderness in California with a friend of mine, and we got stuck out. I think the car died out there. So we had to have somebody come out, out in the middle of nowhere, out in the desert, and jump my car, which they did. So, and he said, well, your car's expired. He said, were you going to renew it? Absolutely. But I mean, you didn't want to pay that whatever it was back in the 1960s, but once you didn't have it and you had your car break down, boy, that sure looked good, and that's how this works. You kind of foresee evil, and maybe it doesn't come, but when you need it, you need it. And if you've not purchased it, you're in trouble. And so it's a good thing. It is a good principle to follow. A prudent man foresees evil and hides himself. However, it says the simple pass on. The simple just go on and oblivious to danger, oblivious to things possibly going wrong. And what does it say? And are punished. You suffer the consequences. You suffer the consequences. So, what I would like to do, and this principle applies not only spiritually, but it also applies physically, and we're going to primarily think about things in a physical sense today, but there's also a spiritual side to all of this that, as you'll see. And what we're going to do is we're going to apply Proverbs 22, verse 3, to our everyday financial and economic lives. As you think about, you know, here we are, we're meeting in this building, and we are thankful that we can meet here. We're thankful we can have air conditioning. And as we all look at our individual lives, I think everybody has a place to live. I don't think any of you are living in your car or living in a tent or, you know, living on the street or in a box. We all have places to live. We all have food on the table. We all have something to eat. We have clothes to wear. We have transportation. And we have some form of income. And that's all a good thing, and hopefully that continues. But could all that change? Could all that change? Could the economy go into a real tailspin? Could that actually happen? Could there be a stock market crash, wiping out our pensions and our savings? Could there be bank closures? Could there be loss of jobs? Could there be drought and crop failures? Could the government be unable to finance all of its obligations? Is that a possibility? They would not be able to send you your Social Security check, your Medicare, take care of your Medicare or your Medicaid. Is that a possibility? Now, you may be all thinking, oh, man, what a downer. This is terrible. And, you know, the end of the world as we know it. Well, I'm telling you that if you look out on the horizon, you know, like it says here, the prudent man foresees evil. The prudent man looks out and says, you know what? Things could go badly. And if they do go badly, what am I going to do about it? Now, you can be simple and just go on and say, well, everything's going to work out. I don't have to worry about anything. I'm not sure that's what God is expecting of you and me. I'm not trying to scare everyone, but what's your plan if you lose your job and there is not one to be had? What happens if you lose your home? Where do you go? Hopefully somebody will take me in. It'd be a long walk to Texas, possibly, but maybe they'll take us in. What happens if there's no food available to in the store? What happens if you don't even have the money to, if there is food in the store, you don't have the money to buy, to pay for the transportation down there to get it? If economic calamity hits, what's your plan? The Bible, as we see, tells us these things can happen. And amazingly, there are people in our midst who have actually experienced this to one degree or another. They grew up in what is called the Great Depression. They grew up in the late 20s and 30s. We still have a few of those people around who went through it, and they know what life was like back then. Now, I have never experienced that. Okay, I was born in 1951. And we have lived in a period of unparalleled prosperity. Okay? I never missed a meal except by choice. Okay? Never. Okay? And until I came in the church, I didn't know what not having three squares a day was. And I only did without three squares on the Day of Atonement in 1972 because that's what God told me to do. So I've not experienced a deprivation. Now, yes, I had to watch black and white TV, and yes, I had to wear Roebuck jeans instead of Levi's. Yes, I did have to suffer, but I did have clothes, and I did have food on the table, and I did have a roof over my head. So we weren't rich or anything, but we were okay. We did okay. And most of us have grown up in that kind of situation, but people growing up in the 30s, life was hard. You know, we can go back to that time. It was, if you go back to the 1920s, it was a boom time. But then in 1929, in October, you had the stock market crash and all of the other challenges that hit the economy at that time. The economy foundered, factories and businesses shut down, men were out of work. Food lines, poverty, homelessness, tent cities, hobos traveling the roads and rails to find work. You know, you can go back and you can see all kinds of pictures of what it was like back then. You know, hundreds of people standing in a line, soup kitchens, people suffering. Making the problem worse were crop failures. You had the Dust Bowl. I mean, you look at those pictures. Those are amazing pictures to see this great, huge dust storm engulfing this farm. And no water. Part of that was due to bad farming practices and a drought hitting the Dust Bowl area and wiping out the crops. And many of those people had to uproot, and many of them moved to California. So you had the California Okies. And if you look at the social strata in California, once the Okies moved there, you had the people that had been there a while, and then you had the Mexicans were kind of the low man on the totem pole till the Okies moved there, and then the Okies were the bottom of the barrel in the social strata of the time. They didn't have anything, and they were poverty-stricken, but they moved to California because it had to be better than living in the Dust Bowl. You also had the challenge that the economy went through because of bad decisions by the government. the Depression lasted longer in America than any place else in the world because of bad governmental policy. And one thing to consider about the Depression is that it hit the whole nation. It just didn't hit one group of people. It hit everybody, and including Christians. Now, we live in uncertain times, and while we can't foresee every problem that may come our way, we as Christians must do what we can to try to be ready when economic calamity comes. In other words, the prudent, the Christian, must look out, he must watch and seek to discern what's going on, and then to try to do his best to prepare physically and spiritually. So following the instruction of Proverbs chapter 22, verse 3, we're not to go about our merry way oblivious to the dangers that are around us. And if we continue to live naively or foolishly, we will suffer unnecessarily, and we instead want to be prudent. And being prudent means to see the evil that may be coming your way and to seek to get out of the way. You know, if you notice that a tornado's coming, what are you going to do? Well, I'm going to stay out here and watch it. Yes, you can do that. But I would advise against it. I would advise going to your basement. You know, those people that say, well, I'm going to stay through the hurricane. You know, once that hurricane hits and you've experienced it, you'll probably be saying, I'm leaving. I'm getting in that big mad rush of people outside my city to get away from the coast because I don't want to go through that again. You know, it's all you have to do is go through calamity once, and then you begin to think, maybe I should get out of the way. So we want to find what is the best way to hide ourselves. And what we have to recognize is that God's people throughout history have had to face hard economic times. It's not been hard economic times all the time, but they've had to face it. And what we want to do is take a look at the hard economic times that God's people have faced and what they did about it. And the Bible has a number of different examples of people facing these difficulties, and we can look at them and say, well, what did they do? And then it should give us some idea of what we should do as well. So I'd like to begin with Noah. We're all familiar with that story. Now, talk about being wiped out. His whole world was wiped out. Whoosh, it's all gone. The world he knew was washed away. And he gets off the boat with seven other people. And that's it. And a bunch of animals. That's all there is. That must have been an amazing time to get off the ark when the waters had gone down enough to where you can get off. And there's nothing else there except you and your family and the animals that God has preserved. I'm sure that was quite an amazing thing. All your friends are gone. If you had other relatives, they're gone. Everybody's gone except for you. So his whole world was turned upside down, and he had to begin again. So we see, and as you think about Noah was told to prepare, wasn't he? He was to prepare a boat, a really big boat, and he was to gather provisions to put on that boat. Now, God could have built the boat for him, couldn't he? I think God has the ability to create a boat, build it, and to build a boat better than any of us could build. But God had him build it. And God could have gathered all the provisions, but you know what? He had Noah gather all the provisions, didn't he? You gather them. You put them on the boat. Now, I'm going to give you the instructions, but you're going to carry it out. And so, as we think about Noah, we know that a time of great evil and trial happened to him. And as we look out into the future, we have to realize the same thing's coming our way. Because the Bible tells us that it'll be like the time of Noah in regard to evil. But we're also coming upon a time of great upheaval, just as took place in his time. And knowing that, we need to be prepared, not only spiritually, but physically. And the two go hand in hand. And so we have to ask, do we have the provisions we need to provide for ourselves for at least a limited time? I mean, if things go badly, can you provide for yourself for at least a limited time? I'm not talking about a day. You know, I'm talking about weeks or months, maybe even years. Now, I'm not, you know, let's not go crazy here. Man, that guy at Portsmouth is telling us we need to start hoarding food. That's not what I'm telling you. I'm telling you to be prepared and be prudent. So there is a level of prudence here that we all need to keep in mind. As you move on in the Bible to a later time, one of Noah's descendants by the name of Abraham, he had to face a challenge in his life as well. In Genesis chapter 12, verse 10, it says, "Now there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to dwell there, for the famine was very severe in the land." So Abram was living in the land of Canaan, and there was a famine in the land. It was severe. So what did he do? "I'm going where the food is." So he went to Egypt. So even though there was a drought in the area where Abraham was living, he could go to Egypt, and because water came down the Nile from a lot of different areas, it allowed for food to still be grown. So he went down there where there was still food available. So he moved from his temporary home to another temporary home in the land of Egypt. And you know, he had to uproot and move to Egypt. He had already uprooted from Ur to Haran, and finally to Canaan, and now he's uprooting again. So here comes a famine on the land, and you notice Abraham didn't say, "Well, God, why are you giving me this adversity?" He didn't blame God. He dealt with it. Doesn't tell us that he's complaining and all of that. He didn't blame God for his adversity. He did what he had to do to survive hard times. And most importantly, God was with Abraham and his family as they moved to Egypt. And he protected him, watched out for him, and Abraham survived and eventually returned to the land of promise. And what Abraham's situation tells us is that even the faithful suffer at times. They suffer through famines and droughts and those kinds of things. And we also learn from him that sometimes the faithful have to move to deal with the famine. Just like people hit the rails, people were hitchhiking. People did various things in order to find a job back in the 1930s. Sometimes you have no other choice. There is nothing where you're at. So, am I saying we may have to move? I don't know. We may have to go someplace else to survive. But the thing is, God provides a way out of the circumstance. So if we face drought or famine or deprivation or loss of job, then God will provide. God still, if you're walking with God, God is with you through whatever you're going through, and God will see you through. Now, I don't think I don't want to move. I don't want to have to do that, but I have to realize maybe I will. You know, my kids are probably praying to God daily that we don't move in with them. We're praying they don't move back home, but anyway. And we'd love to have them closer, but living that close sometimes poses challenges. Once they move out and establish their own, lives, and they move back, that means you have to completely readjust. Well, I've never made my bed since I left home. Oh, no. I want you to make your bed, and we have to sort that out and establish new laws and things like that. Well, here's the solution. I'm keeping your door closed because I can't stand looking at your messy room or whatever it may be. That's what my mom did when my brother moved back in. He got a divorce and moved back in. She said, "I'm not doing it for you. I'm closing the door." So that's all she did. You can have it as messy as you want in there, but I just don't have to see it. Let's move on to another situation where there were hard times. That's found in Genesis chapter 41. A lot of hard times in the book of Genesis there in the first 2,000 years or so. Genesis chapter 41, and this is the story of Joseph. And in Genesis 41, it talks about the Pharaoh in the time of Joseph who had a dream. Now, Joseph's in prison, but the Pharaoh had a dream. In the first dream, he sees in the dream there are seven fat cows, these great, big, fat, healthy cows. He sees them, and then he sees later in the dream seven lean cows. These are really gaunt cows that they're barely living, but they're hungry, and they eat the seven fat cows. And so I've got cows, okay? Seven fat cows, seven lean cows. And he goes back to sleep and he continues dreaming, and he has seven heads of grain that are just plump and filled with all sorts of grain, a great harvest of grain there. And then he sees seven really poor quality heads, you know, grain, bits of grain there, and they eat the seven good ones. And so they were the seven thin heads, devoured the seven plump and full heads. And so the Pharaoh awoke and from the dream, and he's thinking, what does all this mean? I've had the cow dream, and I've had the grain dream. And so he invited all of his wise men and magicians to come in and explain it. They had no clue. So one of his the people serving in his court remembered, hey, there's a guy that's a dreamer that I know of, and he's in prison. So they got him out. He shaved and got all cleaned up, and Pharaoh asked him to interpret the dream. And he immediately says, I'm not the interpreter of the dream, but God can reveal what that dream means. And so he reveals the dream to Joseph. And then let's begin in Genesis 41, verse 25. Then Joseph said to Pharaoh, the dreams of Pharaoh are one. So both the dream about the cows and the dream about the grain, they point to one thing. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good heads are 7 years. The dreams are one, and the seven thin and ugly cows which came up after them are 7 years, and the seven empty heads blighted by the east wind are 7 years of famine. This is the thing which I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. Indeed, 7 years of great plenty will come throughout all the land of Egypt. But after them, 7 years of famine will arise, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt. And the famine will deplete the land. So the plenty will not be known in the land because of the famine following, for it will be severe. And the dream was repeated to Pharaoh twice, because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass. And they believed that this dream was from God, and they believed, we're being told maybe we should do some preparation. And so Joseph's advice was to apply the principle of Proverbs chapter 22:3, which is, foreseeing evil, hide yourself, get out of the way, get prepared. Going on in verse 33, it says, now therefore let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this, and let him appoint officers over the land to collect one-fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt in the seven plentiful years. And let them gather all the food of those good years that are coming, and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh, and let them keep food in the cities. Then that food shall be as a reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine which shall be in the land of Egypt, and the land that the land may not perish during the famine. And so Joseph is revealing this, and there's the need of a wise man. So the light bulb went off over the Pharaoh's head, and he said, I think you're pretty wise. Maybe you should be the one. And so he puts him over the gathering up of all the grain. Verse 49 says that Joseph gathered very much grain as the sand of the sea until he stopped counting, for it was immeasurable. In verse 53, it says, then the 7 years of plenty which were in the land of Egypt ended, and the 7 years of famine began to come, as Joseph had said. The famine was in all lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. So when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. Then Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, go to Joseph. Whatever he says to you, do. The famine was over all the face of the earth, and Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians. And the famine became severe in the land of Egypt. So all countries came to Joseph in Egypt to buy grain, because the famine was severe in all lands. So they prepared. And when the famine hit, they were prepared for it. Now, maybe they didn't have everything that they wanted, but they did have grain, and they were able to sustain life. And it's interesting that as you look at Joseph used to have huge storehouses of grain. But I'd say that Joseph has become simple in that he's done away with all that. And he's naive. He's not foreseeing evil. He is planning, well, everything's all going to work out. And when it hits, Joseph isn't going to be ready. However, we see this example here, and maybe we should take it to heart. That in the good years, while there are still some good years here, maybe it would be a good idea to prepare. We've not been given any dreams. I've not. You've not. I've not seen seven plump cows and seven ugly cows. I've not seen plump grains or lean grains. And I don't think any of you have either. But we can, if you look out ahead of you, you can see that maybe times aren't going to always be as good. We do know that hard economic times can hit, and knowing that, we can follow Joseph's example by being prepared. Prepare for the lean years. Prepare in the area of what you're going to eat, and prepare in the best way you can financially. The fool, or simple, would continue on in the prosperity until the calamity hit. Think about it. If you look at human beings, they don't do much preparation. All you have to do is look every year before the big snowstorm hits. Okay? Now, my question is, why do every year all of the snow shovels sell out? My question is, don't you keep those things from year to year? I mean, at the end of the snow season, does everybody throw them out? They must. I mean, go to the store once the storm's going to hit. You won't find a snow shovel, no salt, and, you know, no toilet paper, no water. You know, you'll find it's like, you know, but it's every year. And it just tells you most people don't prepare, but when the disaster comes and it's imminent, everybody rushes down there and tries to get their stuff together. I mean, I've had my snow shovel for a year, I bet 20 years, and it's still working really good. It's hard to break snow shovels, you know. I guess you can, be prepared. Don't wait till the calamity hits because it's too late then. So do what you can to prepare for it. And you see Joseph's example, and it's a good example for all of us. And do some preparing. And as we'll see, it's not the total solution. But it is something that would be wise for all of us to do. Let's go to the time of the book of Judges and the book of Ruth. And the book of Ruth begins with famine in the land. It begins with famine in the land. In fact, the famine is so bad that a man by the name of Elimelech and his wife Naomi, and their two sons, they decide that this is so bad that we've got to get rid of our allotted portion of land here in the land of Israel and move on. We can't survive here. So they sold their land. I don't know whether they lived on that money until it ran out, or they took the money and they moved on to the land of Moab. But they couldn't make it in the land of Israel, at least from Elimelech's point of view. So he and his family moved to the land. They moved to the land of Moab. And, as you look at that, you have to realize he lost his job. You know, if you have land and you cannot, your crops won't grow because of drought and there's famine, you've lost your job if you're a farmer. And not only did he lose his job, he lost his land. So what do you do then? They moved on, hoping that things were better in the land of Moab. So they moved there, and they took up residence there, and his two sons married two women from the land of Moab, and then Elimelech died in the land, and the two sons died, and all that was left was Elimelech's widow and the two daughters-in-law. And eventually, we're told that God had visited his people by giving them bread. Things improved in the land of Israel. And Naomi said, well, I guess we can move back home. And so she was going to move back to her hometown in the area of Bethlehem. And, the two daughters could go with her or not. And she said, you don't have to. This is your homeland. You can stay here. And one decided to go back to her home, and the other, and Ruth decided to go with Naomi. apparently they were lived God's way to the extent where Ruth had come to accept that way of life. And she moved back to the land of Bethlehem with her mother-in-law, Naomi. So they moved back. They had no property. They had no place to grow crops or anything like that. They did move back, and apparently they found a place to live. And how were they going to survive? You have a widow. You have two widows here. How are they going to survive? Well, God had made provision for that, saying that, you know, those poor and widows in the land, they can go out, and after the farmers have gone through and collected their grain, they can come through and glean. And they can get what's fallen to the ground or what's left over. And they were not to harvest corner to corner. They were to leave the corners for gleaning. And, God is working out his providential efforts here with Naomi and Ruth, because it just so happens that Ruth goes to the field of Boaz. And Boaz protects her and provides for her and makes sure that she has grain. And so they do survive. And God is very much a part of all of this. And as we look at Naomi and Ruth, we have to keep in mind that we are just as much God's people as Naomi and Ruth. You know, Boaz was the redeemer, redeemed Naomi and Ruth in the land, and restored it to Elimelech's family. He didn't have to do that, but he was willing to do that. He willingly redeemed them, paid the price that was necessary in order to help them. And the thing is that we have been redeemed spiritually speaking, and if we get into trouble, God will redeem us as well and will restore us. And we have to always remember that whatever we lose physically, God says he will restore to us, that he will provide for us. He will take care of us. And that is, as you look at Ruth, you look at all they went through, God was there. And God eventually brought them through it. And do you think we're of less value than Ruth or Naomi? I don't think so. We are God's people, and God will watch out for us and will provide for us spiritually and physically. So let's move on to another hard time. Moving on to the 1 Kings chapter 17. 1 Kings chapter 17. 1 Kings 17 is an example of bad government. Bad government. And God's people have experienced bad government over their history and will continue to experience that. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. And so we're just kind of on the bus, and wherever the bus is going, okay, here we go. We can't fix it. And we just are along the ride for the ride sometimes. But what happened is Ahab, the son of Omri, he came to the throne of Israel. Came to the throne of the northern kingdom. And Ahab is condemned in the scriptures for continuing in the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat. Jeroboam set up all calves in a couple of places in Israel. He was trying to ensure that people didn't go up to the feast and people did not return to the true religion in order to maintain power. And Ahab wanted to maintain power, so he continued those policies. And not only did he continue those policies, he went further. And he did that by marrying Jezebel, going against the direct prohibition of Scripture not to marry a non-Israelite. He married Jezebel, who was from the area of Sidon. And their whole culture and form of worship was different than that of Israel. And so he married, she was a Baal worshiper, an ardent Baal worshiper. And marrying her was bad enough, but he also built a temple to Baal and sanctioned Baal worship in the land. And Jezebel not only brings Baal worship into the land, but attempts to destroy all the prophets of God. Things got so bad that one of Ahab's governors actually ends up saving 100 of them and protecting them, because they're being hunted down because of their adherence to the true religion. So God said, this isn't good. I'm going to punish your nation for this. And in 1 Kings 17, verse 1, we see the prophet Elisha coming into the picture. 1 Kings 17, verse 1. And Elijah, the Tishbite of the inhabitants of Gilead, said to Ahab, as the Lord God of Israel lives, therefore whom I before whom I stand, there shall not be dew nor rain these years except at my word. Now that's really bad when you don't have rain or even dew. It's hot, but there is dew. When you don't have dew, it's real dry. It's really bad. Hard for things to survive. And what's being described here is the beginning of a 3.5-year drought and famine that was coming upon the land of Israel. And that drought is a forerunner of the type of drought that is referred to in Revelation chapter 11. That's in the context of the two witnesses. However, the end-time drought is going to be much greater in scope as the dire events preceding Christ's return unfold. We aren't at that point yet. We aren't at that point. That's something that's coming. And I'm not telling you here today that that's on the horizon immediately. But it is coming. But let's just look at, as you look at an economic storm, what makes it worse is when you don't have the availability of food. When water is scarce and food is scarce, then times are really tough. So let's go. So there's a drought and famine that's going to hit the land. And let's go to verse 2, see something, verses 2 through 4, and see something interesting that takes place. Verse 2, then the word of the Lord came to him, saying, get away from here and turn eastward, and hide by the brook Cherith, which flows into the Jordan. And it will be that you shall drink from the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to feed you there. So he tells, okay, you've delivered the message to the king. You need to get out into the wilderness and stay by this brook, and I'll provide for you. You'll have something to drink, and the ravens will bring you food. That must have been interesting. I'm not sure what they brought, but they brought something to him, and he had something to eat. Now, I'm not sure that birds are going to provide for us. You know, we're going to have ravens showing up, but if God can do that for Elijah, God can certainly do that for us. Might he do that for the two witnesses? Possibly. I don't know. But if God can do that for Elijah, he could do that for us if we are in that toughest situation. That's why when people tell you, you know, when times get bad and there's no food, would you eat somebody? No. I just look at this example and realize God would provide. I don't know of any ravens around, but some kind of birds. There are plenty of birds around. Maybe they'd show up with something. Hopefully they would. Let's go to verse 5. It says, so he went and did according to the word of the Lord, for he went and stayed by the brook Cherith, which flows into the Jordan. The ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning, and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook. And it happened after a while that the brook dried up because there had been no rain in the land. So things went from bad to worse. You know it's bad when, you know, birds are bringing you bread and meat. But things got worse. So what happened then? So the drought continues, and he continues to suffer, and it brings us to another interesting situation where things aren't so good. Let's go to verse 9. Arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon. Isn't it interesting that Jezebel is from where? She is from Sidon. And here is Elijah told to go to that very place. It's kind of ironic. Arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and dwell there. See, I have commanded a widow there to provide for you. So he arose and went to Zarephath, and when he came to the gate of the city, indeed a widow was there, gathering sticks. And he called to her and said, please bring me a little water in a cup that I may drink. He's asking for something that's virtually non-existent at this point. There isn't much water around. Verse 11, and as she was going to get it, he called to her and said, please bring me a morsel of bread in your hand. So can you bring me a little bread and a little water? So she said, as the Lord your God lives, I do not have bread, only a handful of flour in a bin and a little oil in a jar. And see, I am gathering a couple of sticks that I may go in and prepare it for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die. This is the end of the road. Once I make tortillas or whatever we have here, this is it. We may make a big thick one and enjoy it, and then that's all, it's all gone. So things are pretty dire for this woman and her child. Verse 14, for thus says the Lord God of Israel, the bin of flour shall not be used up, nor shall the jar of oil run out until the day the Lord sends rain on the earth. You know, and so God's going to provide for her. He says in the verse before, do not fear, go and do as you have said, but make me a small cake from it first and bring it to me, and afterward make some for yourself and your son. And he says, it's not going to run out. And you know, it didn't. It didn't run out. So somehow or other, in that you know, if you were looking in that jar of oil, you would see that we're down to the bottom. There's nothing else. This is it. There's nothing else in there. And if you were looking in that bin with the flour, you would look and say, this is it. There is no more. Now, how did God keep replacing that? I don't know. Do you think God filled it up? You know, they used it all up, and the next day it was filled to the brim? I don't think so. I would imagine they probably went and found what they needed. And they found it day after day, time after time, because God was there with them and he provided for them. So as you think about our lives, and if things get tough, you think God could provide for us? I think he could. I think he could, and he will. God's provisions through the multiple miracles we see here should encourage our faith, because God was taking care of his people, and he will take care of us as well. As we go forward to another famine, we're looking at all the famines here in the book of Nehemiah. Let's go to Nehemiah chapter 5. Nehemiah chapter 5. Nehemiah chapter 5, we find the people being oppressed. The people who had returned from captivity in Babylon are being oppressed. Now, who's oppressing them? Who's oppressing them? They're being oppressed by their brothers, their own family members. Their fellow Jews are oppressing them. And people are suffering. And Nehemiah becomes aware of this. Let's go to chapter 5 and look at verse 1. It says, there was a great outcry of the people and their wives against the Jewish brethren. For there were those who said, we, our sons and our daughters, are many, and therefore let us get grain that we may eat and live. So they were suffering. They didn't have what they needed. Verse 3, there were also some who said, we have mortgaged our lands and vineyards and houses that we might buy grain because of the famine. There's been a famine, so they've mortgaged their properties in order to buy grain. So once you mortgage your property and somebody else takes it over, where do you live? How do you produce a crop? It's gone. Once you mortgage it, it's gone. So that was the predicament they were in. Verse 4, there were also those who said, we have borrowed money for the king's tax on our lands and vineyards. Yet now our flesh is as the flesh of our brethren, our children as their children, and indeed we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves. They were economically enslaved. And some of our daughters have been brought into slavery. It is not in our power to redeem them, for other men have our lands and vineyards. They had no way of buying them their way out of it. They didn't have the money. It was gone. So Nehemiah looks at this situation and he sees, you, Jews, are oppressing these people, your own brothers and sisters. You have come, you were in captivity in Babylon because of your sin. You are in captivity, and God has brought you back here, and you're oppressing your brothers and sisters. How can you do that? How can you do that? So what Nehemiah does is he forces them to make restoration. And they did. They did make restoration. But you can see when hard times come, you can take advantage of other people. Properties become cheap, and you can take advantage of other people. And you can even take advantage of one another. Yeah, I know you need some flour, and I'll sell it to you for this. You can do that. But the example here is maybe you shouldn't. Maybe you shouldn't. Maybe when hard times come, it's not a time to take advantage of one another. To take advantage of others when they're down. Maybe it's not a good idea to do that. So when there are hard times and you have money, should you take advantage of others? Or you have something that you can give, should you take advantage of others? I'd be careful about that, as we'll see. Another example we see here is there was a famine in Judea. There was a famine in Judea, and there are several examples in the Scripture where, what do? A collection was taken for them. Brethren in one part of the world who were not suffering gave to help those other brethren. And we see Paul making that collection and taking it back to Judea. We see that happening a couple of times in the New Testament. And it gives us the instruction that we are to help out our brethren who might be in need. We are to share what we have with them. Now, let's summarize here and look at the lessons that we've seen. And the reason I think that, you have to look at reality here. And I'm trying to be realistic. You know, I see that it's very unlikely that I'm ever going to retire. I don't believe it's going to happen. 10 years ago, we might have thought, things are going good and I'll eventually retire and all that. It's not going to happen. I'm going to work and so long as I can work. And I don't think there's any other reality. I don't believe there's going to be money for me to retire on. Maybe for you, and I hope this doesn't happen, but let's be realistic. It's becoming more uncertain as the day goes on. Do you think your taxes are going to increase or decrease in the coming years? If you think they're going down, tell me, please explain to me what you're basing that on. Taxes are going up. We have some friends who have been farmers, and they have farmed a property that they've rented for three generations. And what's happening is, because of taxes, their taxes are going to go up 30%, from 15% to 30%. They can't do it. It's 150 acres, $8,000 an acre. They don't have $12 million to buy that property. But if they can't farm that, that's going to cut their income by a third. Think about when your income's cut by a third. That's a lot of money. But these are the realities that people are facing. So you have to look at, economic times can hit. And you're seeing the beginning, the first wave of it, and it's going to continue, I think. So it's prudent to be prepared. So we see God's people have faced it. For 6,000 years, off and on, God's people have faced this. So are we any different? We could face the same kind of things. So if we're struck by such challenges, we've learned that we have options, don't we? For instance, God provided for Abraham and Jacob a place to go for food in tough times. And, so we have to kind of, if you face tough times, you got to kind of be innovative. You got to think outside the box. You got to think, okay, where do I go? Where is a place where they have food? We have to ask God for his wisdom to see if there's a place of relief. And remember 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13, which says, we all face suffering and adversity, but God provides the way of escape. Not a way, but the way, the best way, if you turn to him and seek his wisdom. What is the best way of escape? God will show you. Another lesson that we've learned here is we can follow Joseph's example and prepare for lean times and the good years. You know, we we have some things stored up. I'm not sure how long it'll last. It's not that we would not give to anybody else, but we've stored up some things and tried to be prepared and be prudent for the future. So, you know, you have things that stick around a while, like beans and those kind of things that are dry, and you can cook them up and eat. And there were a lot of people in the Depression who lived on beans and cornbread. Any of you ever go through that? You know, you didn't have a whole lot. But, you know, what is it tonight? Beans and cornbread. What are we having for breakfast? Beans and cornbread. Maybe we've got a cow and we milk the cow and we have some milk. You know, but times were lean. And you have to realize today, back in the 30s, you had a lot of people that still were tied to the farm. How many people are tied to the farm today? Plant what? You know? People don't know how to do that. So we need to follow Joseph's example and prepare for lean times in the good years. You know, have some cash on hand. Do you have some cash? My wife works with people that have no cash. You know, if they have to get a new set of tires, they have no money to buy tires. They don't have it. It's just, what are you talking about? Savings? What is that? They don't have any clue. You should have some savings. You know, accumulate the best you can. You should, if you have debt, reduce it. Don't be taking on debt. Be very careful about that in the current economic situation. And as I said, you need to have some water and some food stored. Be prepared. Be prepared. I would be prepared for a longer term emergency than just like a week or a weekend. If, you know, we've seen a 3.5-year famine, drought and famine. We've seen a 7-year years of famine and difficulty in Joseph's time. So those are realities. Also, we don't want to use the hard times to take advantage of others. You know, that was brought up in Nehemiah. And let's go back to Luke 12 and see what Christ has to say about that. Luke chapter 12. Don't use the hard times to take advantage of others. Luke chapter 12, verse 45. It says here, but if that servant says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming, in the context of the coming of Christ, and begins to beat the male and female servants, and to eat and drink and be drunk, the master of that servant will come on a day that he is not looking for him. So he begins to look at the circumstances. Christ is not coming. He's delaying his coming, and he begins to take advantage and oppress his fellow servants. That's not what we should do. He said, basically, your focus has become on the physical versus the spiritual. You know, as you think about, let's say that you have food. What are you going to do with your neighbor? What are you going to do with them? They don't have any. What are you going to do? Are you going to say, well, you idiot, you didn't see these hard times were coming? I'm not sharing anything with you. I'd say things are going to probably turn negative at that point with your neighbor. You're going to have to help your neighbor. Yeah, but they're eating all my food. You know what? Then you better be counting on the birds and the and God providing for you. And God will. But it's going to be a chance to exercise your Christianity, even when you say this seems foolish if I do give to my neighbor. But if you've been prudent and saved, shouldn't you give to your neighbor? Isn't that what Joseph did? He didn't hoard it all and then say, ha ha, I'm not sharing this with you. We're to do the same thing. So we are not to take advantage of others and mistreat others for gain in hard times. We are to have a giving heart even when we are suffering hard times. You know, as I said, you may have to share. And think of the widow of Zarephath, her example. She's down to the bottom of the barrel of everything, isn't she? But she did fulfill Elijah's request and made the cake for him and gave him some water. Her example is our example that we should follow. And God will provide for us. God miraculously provided for her, and he will provide for us. I do hope that I have one of those magic bins of flour and a magic jar of oil. And we may just be eating tortillas, but you know what? I'd rather have tortillas than nothing. I may make cornbread versus tortillas, but that's okay. Also, we can use the principle of Proverbs chapter 22, verse 3 to prepare for hard times. It's only prudent to get out of the way of evil. If you see evil coming, get out of its way. At the same time, we have to remember that we can make all the physical preparations we want. You can, I know my son-in-law has told us numerous times, he said, if things go bad, we're coming back because we've seen all the food in your basement. Okay? So it's not that good, but I mean, there is more food than he's seen in any basement before. And so we can have all the food we want, but that's not what's going to help us to survive. That's prudent, and we should do it. But really, the best insurance we have of survival is our relationship with God. We have to remember that while we can prepare for hard economic times, physical things aren't going to save us. There are people who have total confidence in all the food they've stored up in their bomb shelter or wherever they have it. They have total confidence in their finances. But, you know, there are some scriptures that don't give me confidence in those things. Let's go to Ezekiel chapter 7. Ezekiel chapter 7. And one of the things that people are buying a lot of today is gold. Okay? They're buying gold. Nothing wrong with buying gold. But you know, gold is going to have no value when there's nothing to buy with it. You know? You may be able to buy electronics with it, but you can't eat electronics. Okay? So, I think it's prudent to have something of value, such as gold or silver or something like that, because it has a real worth. Okay? But when there's no food, it has no value at that point. But Ezekiel chapter 7, verse 19, it says here, they will throw their silver into the streets, and their gold will be like refuse. Their silver and their gold will not be able to deliver them in the day of the wrath of the Lord. They will not satisfy their souls nor fill their stomachs because it became their stumbling block of iniquity. You know, being focused on the physical was where they were focused. And they've accumulated all this, and God said, you have nothing to buy with it. And at that point, you may as well throw it in the street because there is nothing of value to be had. I would say if you're thinking about what you're going to do to provide a way for yourself to survive, if you can produce something, I would say you've got a greater chance of survival. You know, like this year we went out and picked blueberries. And I mean, if you have blueberries, they were good, there were a lot of them, and you have something that people can eat, you're always going to have something you can sell. You're always going to have something you can produce and you can share with somebody else. If it's a garden or whatever it is, you have something you can sell. The Amish have caught on to that, believe it or not. Where do many of us go and buy stuff? Those Amish guys have tomatoes and corn and all that. For those like me that don't have those things growing. But they have something that they produce through the sweat of their brow or by walking behind their mule or their horse. They're producing it and they're selling it. So if you have something you can produce and you can sell, then you're always going to come out okay. Just a thought. Because when people get hungry, if you have something that they can buy that you've produced and you have an abundance of it you can sell, that's going to stand you in good stead. But guess what? It requires some work and some sweat, but it's worth your time. Something to consider. But anyway, you see here that money isn't going to save you when there is no food to be had. Also in Proverbs 11, verse 28, it says, "He who trusts in his riches will fall, but the righteous will flourish like foliage." The righteous will flourish. He's going to flourish because of his relationship with God. And that's what's going to save us more than anything. You have the parable of the rich fool. Let's go to Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12. This is an interesting chapter here in what it talks about. But it's talking about people that are focused on the physical things, the money and all of those kinds of things. And so Christ gives a parable here in Luke chapter 12 and beginning in verse 15. Christ said to them, "Take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses." Verse 16, "Then he spoke a parable to them, saying, 'The ground of a certain rich man yielded plentifully. And he thought within himself, saying, "What shall I do, since I have no room to store my crops?" So he said, 'I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build greater, and there I will store all my crops and my goods. So I can expand my basement, I guess, and put more stuff in there, you know. But if that becomes my focus, my reason for being,'" what does he go on to say? Verse 19, "And I will say to my soul, 'Soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry.'" So I look in there and I say, man, look at all that wheat and all that oatmeal and all the good things I've got in here stored up. I'm good. I don't care what happens. They can drop the big one. I'm good. Doesn't matter what happens. I'm good. And he goes on to say, "But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul will be required of you. Then whose will those things be which you provided?'" God's saying, your life could come to an end, and then all those barns and all that storehouse you have is pretty much worthless. Verse 21, so is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. That's where our riches have to be. It's not in gold. It's not in the things we store. Although that's prudent, that's not our focus. And even when, and see, the challenge will be when times get tough is to keep your eye on the ball. When you are down to nothing and it's living as a Christian or giving it up in order that I can have a job and I can put food on the table, then it's crunch time. It's crunch time. Will you remain faithful? You have to say, you know where my riches are? They're with God. I may die. I may starve to death here. I mean, I'm going to do everything I can to survive, and I think that God will provide for me. I know the examples are there, but he may not. So what am I going to do? Am I going to remain faithful or not? Am I rich? Is that where my riches are, ultimately speaking? He goes on to tell us, beginning in verse 22, he says, "Therefore I say to you, do not worry about your life and what you will eat, nor about the body, what you will put on." Don't, you know, be prepared, but don't worry about it. Don't spend your time worrying about it. Life is more than food, and the body is more than clothing. It shouldn't be consumist. It shouldn't be our focus. "Consider the ravens, for they neither reap nor sow nor reap, which have neither storehouse nor barn, and God feeds them. Of how much more value are you than the birds?" He says, "And which of you by worrying can add one cubit to his stature?" So, I've worried a lot, and I'm not any taller. You know, so don't worry. You know, I'm not. So when I'm telling you these things, realize, you know, be prudent, take steps to prepare. And more than anything, make sure your relationship with God is where it should be. He says, "If you then are not able to do the least, why are you anxious for the rest? Consider the lilies, how they grow and neither toil nor spin. And yet I say to you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. If then God so clothes the grass which today is in the field and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, how much more will he clothe you, O you of little faith?" And do not seek what you should eat or what you should drink, or nor have an anxious mind. For all these things the nations of the world seek after, and your Father knows that you need these things. But seek the kingdom of God, and all these things shall be added to you. If that's where your heart is, if that's what you're seeking, God says be prudent, be prepared. But at the same time that you do your preparation, you say, you know what? This isn't going to save me. My salvation lies with God. God is my Redeemer. God is the one who restores me and provides for me. That's where it's really at. But I'm going to be prepared. And if it all runs out, it all runs out. God will take care of me. And I will practice my faith. Seek God's kingdom, and all these things shall be added to you. And keep this overall in mind. Do not fear, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Always keep that in mind. God called you, and his desire above all others is to see you in his kingdom. And he may test us with hard times, but you know what? He wants us to survive, and he will provide for us because he wants us to be given that kingdom. He says, sell what you have and give alms. Provide yourselves money bags which don't grow old, a treasure in the heavens that does not fail, where no thief approaches nor moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. So think about these things. Think about these things and keep in mind Proverbs chapter 22, verse 3. Be a prudent person. And look out there and see what's coming and try to be prepared as well as you can. Follow the examples you see in the scriptures. And the main thing is, don't make it your focus and become obsessed with it. Prepare for it, but make sure you know where your treasure is. And that is with the great God and your relationship with him. So that when it's all said and done, if we have to go through these economic times, hard economic times, we can help each other, support each other, encourage each other through it, and we'll all end up as a part of that kingdom, because we've all valued it and treasured it as we should.